upon me, well, oh well. I'm a girl.
We're told that after the war the Nazis vanished without a trace. But the battalions of fascists still dream of a master race. The history books, they tell of their defeat in 45. But they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died.
They say the prisoner of Spandau was a symbol of defeat. Was Hess remained in prison, then the fascists, they were beat. So the promise of an Aryan world would never materialise.
So why did they all come out of the woodwork
on the day the Nazi died? The world is riddled with maggots, the maggots are getting fat. They're making a tasty meal of all the bosses and bureaucrats. They're taking over the boardrooms and they're fat and full of pride. And they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. So if you meet with these historians, I'll tell you what to say. Tell them that the Nazis never really went away. They're out there burning houses down and peddling racist lies. And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of Syrup Moose Radio, the award-winning anti-fascist radio show of your dreams. This show is produced on the unceded territory of the Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en peoples in so-called Canada. And we are coming to you on 93.9 FM, CICK, Smithers Community Radio. You could also be listening on 98.1 FM, CJSF, 102.7 FM, CKMS, 88.3 FM, CKXU, or 88.7 FM, CFUR. Huge thank you to every station running this show. Syrup Moose Radio is sponsored by the Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition. Search them on Facebook and see the truly incredible work that they are doing. For more from this show or the person who makes it, head to www.themarsh.ca and see what else they're working on. To submit music, comments, or anything else, email syrupmooserecords@gmail.com. Let's get on with it. F-A-F-O 1312.
Nazi punks, fuck off, take three.
Nazi punks, fuck off, by the Dead Kennedys. This is Syrup Moose Radio, and ooh, man, have we got a show this week. I don't know if you can already tell, but I'm feeling a little hot about this, and I'm going to give a little bit of context before we get started. So, I am recording this on Sunday, February 8th, and last night, February 7th, in Smithers, British Columbia, where this show is situated, there was a town hall meeting called Understanding DRIPA, the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples Act. And this particular piece of this particular hall was hosted by John Rustad, conservative MLA for the Nechako Lakes, Sharon Hartwell, conservative MLA for Bulkley's Valley Stikine, and mediated or moderated or whatever by Bruce Banman, a conservative MLA from Abbotsford South. Now, what you'll notice about all of those people is that they are all conservative MLAs, and none of them are Indigenous people. In fact, there were no Indigenous people invited to speak at this information session about an Indigenous issue. And what followed, as far as I can tell so far, was absolute trash. I was not able to attend, but I am very grateful that someone live streamed it. And I'm going to be sharing the entire live stream with you. In pieces, I'm going to try and edit it because it is, I believe, a little long for my particular show. However, the live stream is on Facebook. And, you know, the one good thing I'll ever say about Facebook is that it does seem to be an extremely valuable tool in Smithers and Hazleton as a way of making sure information is public. So, also, the information notice was posted and shared by the Smithers District Chamber of Commerce, who I think do bear some embarrassment and responsibility on that. They claim to only be sharing information, and they have nothing to do with the planning or the organization of it or whatever. But you know, you're it's an endorsement, frankly. And you know, Sharon Hartwell has demonstrated herself to be a liar, and we've seen it. I've done a whole episode about that in regards to the Bulkley Valley Harm Reduction Society's work and the smear campaign that Sharon Hartwell attempted with them. So we're going to play as much of this town hall as I can fit into the show. I may come in and out with some thoughts. I'm going to probably edit down some of the question period stuff. It's long, and I'm going to let the John Rustad opening statement play out. It's about 20 minutes, and it is dry. But more importantly than it being dry is it's wrong in a lot of places. And thankfully, people in the audience do call it out. It is fear-mongering trash. And I should not have expected any less from the BC Conservatives. But there we are. So we're going to let it play out, and then I'll come back after the statement from Rustad, and we'll go into what people had to say in sort of a brief skim of the stream. It does look like people were not going to just take this, and I was extremely gratified to see that. I will seek permission to credit the person who shared this live stream to make sure I can use their name. But in the meantime, I won't be using anybody's name, and we're going to get to it. So this is the they'd already been speaking when the live stream started, so I'm not sure how much is missed. I don't think truthfully that much could have been. But you will hear what is blatantly wrong information. And please note that this is not in the interest of platforming John Rustad. This is in the interest of sharing with you the real things that the elected people that are supposed to represent this area say and believe. And I think that that is really important. You may hear from time to time commentary from the person doing the live stream. This was filmed on their phone. So, bear that in mind. And yeah, I'm just going to get to Rustad's opening statement. Here it is.
How the Supreme Court decided to define title. But in any case, so as things continue to progress, I'll take one step back because I forgot one component of support. In 1991, 1992, knowing that this constitutional issue was still there, knowing that we needed to address the issue of title and rights, we started what was called the BC Treaty Process, which was a process that many nations went in with a lot of hope in terms of how it would work, how it would proceed. Unfortunately, it did not produce the results that lots of people had been interested in or were interested in doing, and so it kind of floundered. And today, we had a handful of nations that have gone through. We've got three current nations that their legislation for implementing treaty will be coming to the legislature this spring for debate. There's been five other nations in BC that have entered into a modern treaty. The first one was not done through the BC treaty process, and that was with the Nisga in terms of the treaty that happened in British Columbia. So all of this is built up to where we're doing. In my period of time when I was minister from 2013 to 2017, we were respecting the case law. We were going forward. We were doing agreements. I am covering everything from cultural agreements to creation of First Nations Health Authority to economic agreements, revenue sharing, a whole wide range of things around that, including return of some land to First Nations in specific cases. From there, when after 2017, the NDP, when they came to power, decided to take an approach of introducing UNDRIP as legislation in British Columbia. Now, prior to that, I had been in discussions with the federal government about actually implementing UNDRIP in BC, and I said there's two or three chapters in DRIPA, or UNDRIP as it's called, the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, which could be interpreted as being very problematic. So we need to find how we would define that, but then still be able to use the UNDRIP as it was intended, which is guidance in terms of building relationships and how to work between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people. However, the federal government at the time wasn't interested in doing that. That was 2016. Come along 2017, the NDP came out, and then they decided to implement this. And it's interesting how it's formed. When you go back and look at the debates in the legislature, it was meant to be, as it was discussed with, as we had discussed and I had discussed it with the federal government, which was, it was meant to be this guiding principle, it was meant to be this introduction of, you know, the kind of components that was meant to help in terms of negotiations. It was not meant to be a veto, it was not meant to be implemented, quite frankly, in the way that it's turning out in British Columbia. And now we're seeing that with court cases and other issues that are happening in the province today. And it's actually very interesting because I went back and looked, and if you look at the original debate on the United Nations Declaration of Rights to Indigenous People in the UN, it was rejected originally because it was considered to be too strong in terms of veto and powers and authorities, and it was changed. And the debate was very clear in the UN that it supported what our perspective was, which was it meant to be as a guiding principle and not coming in as enforced as it is being done today in British Columbia. So it's interesting how UNDRIP has sort of morphed through DRIPA and the Interpretation Act and the implementation in British Columbia. So going forward, we're now in a situation where I want to pose a question to everyone in this audience, which is, what does reconciliation mean? And I'm saying that because we're talking about DRIPA, and we're talking about all these things, court cases, and constitution, and you know all the legal sides of things and implementation, but really, what does reconciliation mean? And I'll give you what I think it should mean, and other people will have some different opinions, I'm sure. Where you have differences or where you've had some challenges between peoples in the past, you need to find a path to be able to bring people forward, bring people together, to reconcile those differences, to find a path forward together. So that tells me two things. First of all, yes, there are issues, there are long outstanding issues that need to be resolved. We need to find a way to resolve those issues, to bring people together. But it also means something else, which means there's an end to reconciliation. You've accomplished it, you've achieved it. And it's not something that goes on forever, because you've brought people together. And maybe that takes decades, maybe that takes months. But you've brought people together and you've addressed the issue. Because if it's going on forever, then you're obviously not reconciled. You're not actually achieving what reconciliation to me is meant to be. And so I also think about it from the perspective of what does that end result supposed to look like? And from my perspective, what I believe it should look like is it should bring equal opportunity for all. There will never be equality for all, because everybody's born different. Everybody has different lots in life in terms of their skills and abilities and things. Not everybody's a brain surgeon. Not everybody is a baseball player. There are differences, but there needs to be an equal opportunity for all. And so I look at reconciliation is, how do we address our past? how do we get to a place where we can bring people together? How do we get to a place where there is that equal opportunity? And now this is why now I'm also want to just talk about why I support the idea of repealing DRIPA. Because when you look in the, around the world, anywhere there has been legislation, anywhere there has been laws that put in place which give rights to one person that are not given to another person, it creates friction. By its own nature, it creates conflict. It doesn't create reconciliation or solutions. You know, if I split this room in half and I say, I'm going to put a gate on the road out there, and the people on this side have a key and the people on this side don't have a key, what happens? Sooner or later, the people on this side say, that's not right. We're not being treated fair. It's not equal. And so you end up in a situation where the people on this side ultimately want to tear down the gate. So what have you done? You've created friction. You've created conflict. And when you look at actually what our Constitution is, and I've got to say this because it's true. When you look at our Constitution, Section 35 was meant to try to resolve the long-standing history and the problems, but it has created two classes of people. And quite frankly, the Indian Act has created two classes of people too. So how do you fix the historic problems that have gone on? How do you right those wrongs? How do you find a path forward? But how do you find a path forward that gets to an end and is able to achieve what I believe should be the goal of reconciliation? How do you get to a place where we don't have to legislate rights for one people that another people don't have? How do you get to a place where we actually have that equal opportunity? Now, it's going to take work. It's going to take, obviously, time. It's not going to happen overnight, and it doesn't just happen immediately. But there has to be a willingness and understanding on both sides that, and an agreement in terms of what needs to be achieved that can be measured from a perspective of equality, that equal opportunity for all. And so, like I say, I look at it and I think, okay, I look at all the agreements that I signed over time, what were they about? Well, they were about recognition, they were about respect, they were about opening up opportunity, they were about having First Nations engaging economically. And it's something that one of the fathers of the Nishka Treaty had said, who has since passed. And he once said that First Nations have been held back economically for decades and decades. And it's high time they have the opportunity to catch up and if possible surpass. I couldn't agree more. Because that's the only way you get to that equal opportunity. But you can't create that. You can't achieve that by saying, I'm going to take from this side of the room and give to this side of the room. It has to be how you create the opportunities to do it. It has to be how you add, how you create those potentials. So that is what my perspective is. Because if you end up, if you tip the balance too far one way or the other on either side of the scale, you can end up with friction. You can end up with conflict. So now I want to talk just a little bit on the Cowichan case. Because this has stirred a lot of emotions, a lot of resentment that I think is actually very dangerous in British Columbia. So the Cowichan case was another finding of title, which is fine. That's how you know, we decided this court case stuff should go. Maybe there's an argument to be made that we need to change how these things go. But in the Cowichan case, it has determined that Indigenous title and private property rights can coexist. But here's the problem with that. Both Indigenous title and private property rights give exclusive use to the land. Indigenous rights and Indigenous title gives First Nations the right to go on a property, to utilize a property for its purposes, to benefit from a property. They can introduce Indigenous law, They make decisions based because it's their land, it's their title. Private property rights is the same. If I own a piece of property, I can put up a fence on that piece of property, I can put up a sign saying no trespassing. If somebody comes on the property, I can call the police and have them hauled away because they're trespassing on private property. I get the contract of having private property means I get the value of that property, I can buy, I can sell, I can use that property within the context of provincial law and municipal bylaws. The two cannot coexist. And the judge admitted it and said, yeah, this is going to be a problem. So how do we resolve this issue? It's clearly, it was a finding of title. It's clearly the First Nations had been there, utilized that land, and within the definition of title, within, you know, what our jurisprudence has built over the years, and under Section 35, but it's also clearly private property based on this side. And the challenge is, private property is the foundation of much of our economy and much of our society. And so this has now risen this issue to being very confrontational. I read an article just the other day about, you know, the folks with the Couch and First Nation and talking about all the hate and friction that this is causing. That is not reconciliation, folks. We have to find a way through this, but that is not reconciliation. That's the opposite. That's going to head down a path that is not a good path for our society. So how do you address this? And I talked to a couple of elders from the Nisga Nation about this and said, well, where does this go? And he said, oh, look, we're not going to be kicking anybody off the land. I mean, we're not. None of that sort of stuff is going to happen. But eventually, the land will return to the nation. Okay, so if you accept that, what does that mean? That means your land has no value. You've lost all the value of your land. It means basically you can't sell your land because who would buy it?
Well, you guys all already said it. Fear-mongering. Come on.
I'm saying truth, please. I'm saying truth, and that is the truth of the matter. And if you don't believe that, look what's happened at the Silquitine case and what happened to the private property down there. In terms of the value, it has been dramatically devalued because they don't have road access and there's all kinds of problems and issues. So the challenge is, the challenge that we have as a society is very simple. How do we address these two things that can't coexist?
Who devalued it?
So if we're going to start having outbursts, we're going to end up closing this down real quick. We can't have that. With all the grace to respect. And for those of you that got here a little late, and we've opened it up behind us. This is going to be a respectful dialogue, and we went. So what happens if you want to ask a question when John's finished with his opening statement? You'll stand in front of the microphone, state your name, and ask the question. But if it's going to get into the point where this is one of these things where everybody could start yelling out, it just goes into chaos. It's not a respectful way. It's not a good way.
How much longer so is the opening statement?
We would like the opportunity fair to enough. Speak. There was no land acknowledgement at the beginning of your
so
speech.
Fair enough. So what we're going to do is, if you want to do that, John will be finished in a few minutes, and then please stand in front of the microphone and ask your question. Thank you.
So as I said,
good point.
This is the challenge that we have.
Johnny.
Is private property
no
rights
acknowledgement
versus
of the
indigenous
land.
Rights, indigenous title.
Right?
And it is not reconciled.
Johnny Moore said there's
the
no knowledge acknowledge of the land holder.
How do we solve this? Mm-hmm. And that's, whether it's DRIPA or not, doesn't matter. Because that wasn't done because of DRIPA. There's other issues associated with DRIPA, which is, you know, things like the Mineral Tenures Act, and there's many other things that are going on. But I don't want to go into too much more because obviously there's lots of people that would like to say a few things. But this is the challenge that we face as a province, as politicians, as people in our society, indigenous and non-indigenous alike. This is the challenge that we face. How do we resolve this? Now, I think there is a way forward on this. I think there is a way, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, I talked a lot about what I call economic reconciliation. What are you trying to achieve? If we have 204 nations in the province, 204 decision makers in the province, nothing will get done. How do we achieve this within the context of Canada, within the context of British Columbia, and within the context of respecting the historic people who are here, the Indigenous First Nations? How do we resolve it? And it's not an easy answer. Because it doesn't matter what the answer is, you're going to have friction. So we have to have a path that ultimately goes through these tough waters, but gets to a place where you can achieve what I was talking about, which is reconciliation and equal opportunity. Now I know there's a number of First Nations people here in the room today. You know, I understand what has been taken away. I understand all that. That's why I signed all the agreements.
You have no idea.
Yes, I do.
No, you don't.
So, in any case,
I have no idea.
And I also understand the long-standing, you know, patience, you know, with everything that has been done over time. I get it. That doesn't change the problem that we face as a society and how we try to resolve this and work together. Because I can tell you, there are some people in the First Nation community who say the answer is everybody should just pack up and go back to Europe or whatever country you came from. That's not an answer. We're here to stay, just like Indigenous people are here to stay.
We're still here.
We have to find a path that doesn't create all of this friction, that can be respectful of both rights. So with that, it's a lot to think about, a lot to talk about, and I'm hopeful we'll be able to have some good questions.
Oh, so that was the voice of elected MLA John Rustad, speaking authoritatively on Indigenous issues. I took some notes listening to that. I struggled listening to that partially because it's just very boring to listen to, but also everything he's saying is wrong, and either objectively wrong or fully misses the point and has clearly not been engaged in the actual conversations that we have been having. It's kind of unbelievable. I mean, I'll touch on that last point first. He says that, you know, there's people in the Indigenous community who think everyone should just go back to whatever country they came from. You know what, John? No, they don't. Nobody thinks that what we're going to do is pack up and move back to Europe. No one thinks that sincerely. There might be some, you know, extreme viewpoints. Fine, maybe. And you know what? Were it to be that simple, that we all just go away. But I don't think that there is anybody earnestly saying that everyone should just go back to whatever country they came from. I really don't. And the fact that you use that just shows that you're ill-informed. And I'm not going to harp on this too much because the question and answer bits and pieces that I have heard so far, they really don't let any of that stand. And they're, you know, I'm going to do what this didn't do and allow for Indigenous voices to speak instead of mine. I did want to make a few points, and then I'm going to put in the things. I did also, during that, get permission from the person who did the stream. I'm going to credit them. So it was streamed by Dolly Alfred in two parts. And I have made as little edit as possible. Basically, any editing that I have done has been to ensure that as much of this gets in as possible with as little of silence or stuff that's not clear coming through. So edited for time and clarity, but I have not withheld any information from anybody. And that opening statement really was that bad and dumb. But I will tell you, I will read through some of the notes that I made. One of the first things he says is, what does reconciliation mean? My guy, Indigenous people have been saying what reconciliation means for decades now. This conversation